A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to know what spikenard is and how its oil is produced. Which, I'll admit, sounds like something I'd find in my leaf medicine cabinet. But apparently this is a real thing with actual history behind it. Herman, you're already vibrating.
I am vibrating. This is one of those substances that sits at this perfect intersection of ancient history, botany, chemistry, and frankly some very questionable economics.
That was my reaction, too. You don't expect something that grows at 14,000 feet in the Himalayas to be related to the shrub in your backyard.
But it is. Though I should mention, by the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro.
New voice in the booth.
Spikenard is a flowering plant, Nardostachys jatamansi, that grows in the high Himalayas. We're talking elevations between 3,000 and 5,000 meters, primarily in Nepal, Bhutan, northern India, and parts of China. It's a perennial herb in the honeysuckle family, which surprises people because honeysuckle conjures images of sweet garden vines, not the scraggly high-altitude survivor. The part that matters is the rhizome, that's the underground stem, and the roots attached to it. Those get harvested, dried, and either steam distilled or solvent extracted to produce the oil. The oil itself has been traded for millennia.
That tangled mess is what they're after.
The rhizome is where the aromatic compounds live. When people talk about spikenard oil, they're talking about the essential oil distilled from those rhizomes, and the process is, that's the one. Mary of Bethany anointing Jesus' feet with spikenard oil, and Judas objecting that it could have been sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor. 300 denarii was roughly a year's wages for a laborer at the time.
Let's walk through that. How do you actually get from a muddy root in the Himalayas to a tiny glass vial that costs, what, $200 an ounce?
He complained that it was being adulterated with cheaper oils even back then, which is a fascinating constant in the spikenard trade. The adulteration problem has literally never gone away. Spikenard grows wild at high altitudes, mostly in Nepal, northern India, Bhutan, and parts of China. It takes about 3 years for a plant to mature enough to harvest. You can't rush it. You can't farm it at scale. At least not yet, not reliably. It's both, and the production process is where things get interesting. Let me walk through this. The plant grows wild at extreme altitudes. It's not something you can just cultivate in a convenient lowland farm.
When you say dig up the whole plant, you mean the plant is destroyed.
So there's no harvest the same plant next year scenario. Once harvested, the rhizomes and roots need to be cleaned, dried, and then either steam distilled or extracted using volatile solvents like hexane. Steam distillation is the traditional and preferred method for high-quality oil. You pack the dried material into a still, pass steam through it, and the volatile aromatic compounds get carried off with the steam, then condensed and separated.
Which is exactly the pattern we talked about with spikenard before. The shift from subsistence harvesting to global commodity trade broke the sustainability model. When it was just local use, communities weren't pulling up enough plants to collapse the population.
Now the global market for essential oils and natural perfumes has created this insatiable demand. The harvesting numbers are genuinely alarming. I saw a report from the IUCN, spikenard is listed as critically endangered in some parts of its range. In Nepal, harvests have increased something like 300% over the last two decades. Wild populations can't recover at that rate.
We've got a plant that grows slowly, high in the mountains, gets destroyed when harvested, and is in massive demand globally. That's a recipe for ecological collapse.
And the distillation process itself adds another layer of inefficiency. Once the rhizomes are harvested, they're cleaned, and this is all still done by hand, usually by women in these communities, then dried. Not fully dried, but wilted for a few days because fresh rhizomes apparently yield better oil than completely dried ones. Then they're packed into a steam distillation unit.
What does that actually look like? I'm picturing something rustic.
In some places, it's still traditional copper stills heated over wood fires. In others, there are more modern stainless steel units, sometimes provided by development agencies or private companies. The rhizomes are packed into a chamber, steam is forced through, and the heat causes the cell walls to rupture, releasing the volatile aromatic compounds. The steam carries those compounds through a condenser, where they cool back into liquid. Since oil and water don't mix, the essential oil flows to the top and gets skimmed off.
The yield is terrible, I assume.
We're talking maybe 0.5 to 2% oil by weight of the dried rhizome. So to get 1 kilogram of oil, you need somewhere between 50 and 200 kilograms of rhizomes. That's a lot of dead plants.
The high price isn't just hype. There's a real material constraint.
It's both. The material constraint is real, but there's also a massive adulteration problem that drives up prices for the genuine stuff. Because when something is scarce and expensive, the incentive to cheat is enormous.
Walk me through the adulteration. What are they cutting it with?
All sorts of things. Cheaper essential oils like valerian, which makes a certain botanical sense because valerian is also a rhizome-derived oil with some overlapping aromatic notes. But also synthetic compounds, or just diluting it with carrier oils and selling it as pure. There was a study a few years back that tested commercial samples labeled as pure spikenard oil and found that more than half were adulterated. Some had no detectable spikenard compounds at all.
More than half.
More than half. And this is the problem when you've got a high-value product moving through a supply chain that starts in remote Himalayan villages and ends in boutique shops in New York or Paris. Every middleman has an incentive to stretch the product.
It's the same story as saffron, sandalwood, even truffles. Anything scarce and expensive becomes a magnet for fraud.
Spikenard is particularly vulnerable because most people have no idea what it's supposed to smell like. If you buy lavender oil and it smells wrong, you notice. Spikenard has this complex, earthy, almost damp wood scent that's hard to describe and even harder to authenticate by nose alone, unless you're trained.
Let's talk about what's actually in the oil. You mentioned chemistry earlier. What are the key compounds?
This is where it gets interesting. The main active compounds in spikenard oil are sesquiterpenes. These are a class of terpenes with 15 carbon atoms, as opposed to the more common monoterpenes that have 10. The dominant ones are jatamanzone, also called valeranone, and nardostachone. There's also aristoline, calorine, and a bunch of others. These heavier molecules are what give spikenard its distinctive scent and its therapeutic properties.
They're heavier in a literal sense, higher molecular weight, lower volatility.
That's why spikenard oil is used as a fixative in perfumery. The sesquiterpenes evaporate slowly so they anchor the lighter, more volatile top notes and make the fragrance last longer. This has been known for millennia. Spikenard shows up in perfumes from ancient Egypt, ancient Rome, and of course it's famous from the biblical account where Mary anoints Jesus with an entire alabaster jar of it.
Which, by the way, Judas objects to on economic grounds. He says it could have been sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor. 300 denarii was about a year's wages for a laborer.
That tells you something about how valuable this oil was in the ancient world. It wasn't a casual purchase. It was an extravagant, almost absurdly expensive luxury item. That jar Mary broke open would have been worth tens of thousands of dollars in today's terms.
Which makes the biblical story hit differently when you understand the economics. She wasn't just being generous. She was making a statement that was borderline reckless by the standards of the time.
And the oil itself almost certainly came from the Himalayas. There's archaeological evidence of spikenard being traded along the Silk Road as far back as the 2nd millennium BC. You'd have almost no way to know without lab equipment. The color can be faked, the viscosity can be adjusted. The scent, unless you're a trained nose with experience of genuine spikenard, you're not going to catch a decent fake.
The supply chain was already long and opaque 3,000 years ago. Some things don't change.
Spikenard is just a particularly acute case because the genuine article is so expensive and the supply is so limited. Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine both. In Ayurveda, spikenard, called jatamansi, is considered a cooling, calming herb. It's used for anxiety, insomnia, and what they would call excess heat or pitta imbalance. Plant taxonomy is full of these surprises. The family Caprifoliaceae, if you follow the broader classification, includes everything from honeysuckle vines to valerian to spikenard to teasel.
I'm listening. Show me the data.
It doesn't look like honeysuckle, but the molecular phylogenetics place it firmly in that group. Taxonomy has been through a lot of rearrangements in the last 20 years, as DNA analysis has overturned a lot of morphology-based classifications. Spikenard used to be in Valerianaceae, which was considered a separate family. Now, many sources fold Valerianaceae into Caprifoliaceae. So depending on which reference you consult, you'll see it classified differently.
Comparable to Valium is a strong claim.
It is, and we should be careful not to overstate it. This was one study, it was in rats, and the mechanism isn't fully understood. I contain multitudes, but seriously, the taxonomic confusion has practical implications. If you're trying to regulate trade in an endangered plant, you need to know exactly what species you're talking about. There are related species in the same genus, Nardostachys grandiflora, for example, and there's debate about whether these are truly separate species or regional variants of the same thing. If your conservation regulation lists Nardostachys jatamansi, but harvesters are collecting what they call Nardostachys grandiflora, and a botanist says those are the same plant, but a different botanist disagrees, you've got a regulatory mess. There's no exclusivity to protect, so pharmaceutical companies aren't going to spend millions on clinical trials.
This is exactly the evidence gap problem you talked about before. The economics of drug development don't work for natural products.
They really don't. And it creates this frustrating situation where we have thousands of years of traditional use, we have some preliminary scientific evidence that's intriguing, but we don't have the gold standard randomized controlled trials that would let us say with confidence what it does and doesn't do.
People are paying $200 an ounce for something that might work, might not, might be adulterated, and definitely involves ecological harm.
That's the uncomfortable reality. But I don't want to be too dismissive, because the traditional use isn't nothing. Thousands of years of empirical observation, even if it's not double-blind placebo-controlled, does accumulate real knowledge. The challenge is separating the signal from the noise without the tools of modern science.
The noise includes a lot of overblown marketing claims. I've seen spikenard oil marketed for everything from hair growth to cancer.
The internet essential oil community is, and not always grounded in evidence. Spikenard gets promoted for all sorts of things that have zero research behind them. It's a classic pattern: take a real traditional use, add some vague references to ancient wisdom, and then extrapolate wildly.
Let's pull this together. We've got a plant that's critically endangered in parts of its range, harvested destructively, distilled at terrible yield, frequently adulterated, sold at luxury prices, and used for purposes that range from promising to completely unsubstantiated. What does a sustainable future for spikenard look like?
That's the million-dollar question, or maybe the $200 per ounce question. There are a few things that would need to happen. If spikenard could be reliably farmed at scale, it would take pressure off wild populations. And there are some efforts in this direction. Experimental farms in Nepal and India, some funded by NGOs, some by private companies. But it's tricky. Spikenard has specific habitat requirements. It needs high altitude, cool temperatures, well-drained soil. It doesn't just grow anywhere.
Even if you can cultivate it, you've still got the 3-year maturation cycle. That's a long time to wait before your first harvest.
Which is a real barrier for smallholder farmers. If you're a subsistence farmer in Nepal, you can't afford to tie up land for 3 years growing a crop you might not be able to sell. So any cultivation program has to include some kind of financial support or guaranteed purchase agreements.
You said first cultivation. What's second?
Second is certification and traceability. If genuine, sustainably harvested spikenard oil could be reliably distinguished from adulterated or unsustainably harvested oil, consumers who care could vote with their wallets. There are some efforts here too: fair trade certification, organic certification, some blockchain-based supply chain tracking pilots, but they're small scale and they don't cover much of the market.
Blockchain for spikenard. That's very on brand for Daniel's world.
It really is. He'd probably have opinions on the implementation. But the core idea is sound. If you can track the oil from the specific village where it was harvested, through the distiller, through the exporter, to the retailer, you can verify sustainability and authenticity. The hard part is getting all the players in the supply chain to participate. Third is the less comfortable one, demand reduction, or at least demand modulation. If the global market for spikenard oil keeps growing at the current rate, cultivation and certification alone probably won't be enough. We need consumers to understand that this is a scarce resource, not something to use casually. A few drops in a perfume is one thing. Diffusing it in your living room because a wellness influencer told you to is maybe not the best use.
That's a hard message to sell. Nobody wants to be told their aromatherapy practice is ecologically destructive.
I'm not saying it is, necessarily. If the oil is sustainably sourced, fine. But most of it isn't, and most consumers have no way to know, so the default assumption should be caution.
There's a broader point here about natural products in general. We keep running into this same story. A traditional product that was used sustainably at small scale gets discovered by the global market, demand spikes, and suddenly the resource is collapsing. Sandalwood, rosewood, frankincense, now spikenard. It's a pattern.
It's a tragedy of the commons playing out over and over. And the solutions are always the same basket of things. Property rights, sustainable cultivation, supply chain transparency, consumer education. But implementing them is hard, especially when the production happens in remote rural areas of developing countries with limited governance capacity.
When the product moves through a global supply chain, where every middleman has an incentive to obscure the source, rather than illuminate it.
The current system rewards opacity. If you're a middleman buying spikenard rhizomes from a dozen different villages, some harvested legally, some from protected areas, some adulterated with valerian root, you have no incentive to sort them. You just mix it all together and sell it as spikenard. The distiller doesn't know, the exporter doesn't know, the retailer doesn't know, and the consumer definitely doesn't know.
The plant populations keep declining.
The IUCN assessment I mentioned earlier, and this is publicly available data, classifies Nardostachys jatamansi as critically endangered in the wild. The population trend is decreasing. The main threats are overharvesting for trade and habitat loss from overgrazing and development.
Critically endangered is the last step before extinct in the wild. That's not a theoretical concern.
It's not. And this is a plant that's been harvested for 3,000 years. For most of that history, it was sustainable. Local harvesters had every incentive to manage the resource carefully, because it was their livelihood and their children's livelihood. The breakdown happened when it became a global commodity.
What's being done? You mentioned cultivation experiments and certification pilots. Are there any government-level interventions?
Nepal has listed spikenard as a protected species, which means there are restrictions on harvesting and export. India has it on the CITES list, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Though I believe it's Appendix 2, which means trade is regulated but not banned. Enforcement is the weak link, as it usually is. You can put something on a list, but if you don't have rangers in the mountains checking what's being dug up, the list doesn't mean much.
The harvesters themselves. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that these are some of the poorest communities in the world. They're not destroying the environment out of malice. They're responding to economic incentives like anyone else.
If you're a farmer in a remote village in Nepal and someone shows up offering cash for spikenard rhizomes, cash that might be several times what you'd earn from other crops, you're going to dig up spikenard. The problem isn't individual morality. It's a system that creates perverse incentives.
Any solution has to include economic alternatives. You can't just tell poor communities to stop harvesting and expect that to work.
And this is where some of the NGO programs are trying to make a difference. Setting up community-based management systems where harvesters get a fair price for sustainably harvested rhizomes and where the community has a collective interest in not over-harvesting because they're managing a shared resource. It's the Eleanor Ostrom approach, common pool resource management by the people who actually use the resource.
Ostrom's work showed that communities can manage shared resources sustainably without top-down government control or privatization. But it requires certain conditions, clear boundaries, collective decision-making, monitoring, graduated sanctions for rule-breakers.
Those conditions are hard to establish when you've got external buyers who don't care about the rules and will pay a premium for black market rhizomes. The community management model works great until someone from outside offers to pay more than the community price. Then the incentives start to fray.
We're back to the same knot. The global market creates demand. Demand creates prices. Prices create incentives to cheat, and the resource collapses. How do you break that cycle?
I don't have a clean answer. If I did, I'd be working for a conservation NGO instead of doing this podcast. but I think the direction has to involve some combination of cultivation at scale, which reduces pressure on wild populations, and radical transparency in the supply chain, which lets consumers reward sustainable production. And probably some form of demand reduction through honest communication about the ecological cost.
There's a radical idea.
It shouldn't be radical, but here we are. Most marketing for spikenard oil doesn't mention the conservation status at all. It's all ancient wisdom and pure and natural and spiritual healing. The ecological reality is conveniently absent.
Because it's bad for sales. Ancient wisdom, pure and natural, and also critically endangered due to overharvesting. Doesn't have the same ring.
It really doesn't, but maybe it should. Maybe consumers who care about natural products should also care about whether those products are actually natural in the sense of existing in nature, as opposed to being natural in the sense of having once existed in nature before we harvested them to oblivion.
All right, let's shift gears slightly. You mentioned the chemistry earlier. The sesquiterpenes. What's actually happening at a molecular level when they extract the oil? What makes steam distillation the method of choice?
Steam distillation is the standard for most essential oils because it's relatively gentle. The boiling point of water is 100 degrees Celsius, which is hot enough to volatilize the aromatic compounds, but not so hot that it destroys them. If you tried to extract spikenard oil with solvents, which is done for some other botanicals, you'd get a different chemical profile, and you'd have to deal with solvent residues. Steam distillation gives you the pure essential oil, nothing added.
The sesquiterpenes specifically, why are they the dominant compounds?
That's a plant biochemistry question. Plants produce terpenes for various reasons. Defense against herbivores, attraction of pollinators, protection against pathogens. Sesquiterpenes are built from 3 isoprene units, so 15 carbons total, and they're assembled by enzymes called sesquiterpene syntheses. Spikenard has evolved to produce a particular cocktail of these compounds, probably as an adaptation to its high-altitude environment. Some research suggests that the specific sesquiterpene profile helps protect the plant against UV radiation and cold stress, which makes sense given where it grows.
The very compounds that make it valuable to us evolved for completely different reasons.
As is almost always the case, plants aren't making these molecules for us. We just happen to find them useful. Or in the case of spikenard, we find them pleasant smelling and possibly pharmacologically active.
The difference between the fresh rhizome and the oil. What gets lost in the process?
The oil only captures the volatile fraction, the compounds that can be carried by steam. Anything that's not volatile or that decomposes at distillation temperatures stays behind. So the oil isn't a complete representation of the plant's chemistry. It's a specific subset, and that's important because some of the traditional uses of spikenard involve the whole rhizome, not just the essential oil. In Ayurveda, the dried rhizome is often powdered and taken internally. That delivers a different chemical profile than the essential oil.
Which means the oil and the powder might have different effects, different safety profiles, different everything.
And that's another layer of the evidence gap problem. Most of the modern research has focused on the essential oil or specific isolated compounds, but the traditional use often involves the whole plant material. So we might be studying the wrong thing.
Or at least not the complete picture.
And this is a common issue in ethnopharmacology. Researchers isolate what they think is the active compound, test it, and if it doesn't work, they conclude the traditional use is invalid. But maybe the traditional preparation works through a synergistic effect of multiple compounds that you lose when you isolate a single one.
The whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
Which is philosophically satisfying, but a nightmare for reductionist science. How do you design a controlled trial for a synergistic effect of an unknown number of compounds at unknown ratios? It's hard.
Where does that leave us? We've got a plant that's ecologically threatened, chemically complex, economically valuable, historically significant, and scientifically underexplored. What's the one thing a listener should take away from this?
I think the takeaway is that spikenard is a small case study of a much larger pattern. The tension between traditional use and conservation, between natural products and scientific evidence, between luxury markets and ecological sustainability, this plays out across dozens of species. Sandalwood, frankincense, rosewood, agarwood, now spikenard. The same story, different plant.
The solution isn't just banning trade. That was your point before, and I think it holds. Banning trade drives it underground, makes it harder to regulate, and hurts the communities that depend on it. The solution has to be building institutional and economic infrastructure, cultivation, certification, community management, consumer awareness.
Which is harder than just saying, make it illegal. But it's the only thing that actually works, and we're seeing some progress. There are spikenard cultivation projects in Nepal that are showing real results. The yields are improving, the quality is consistent, and the communities involved are earning reliable income without destroying wild populations. It's not at scale yet, but it's a proof of concept.
That's actually encouraging. A proof of concept means it can be replicated.
The question is whether the market will support it. If consumers are willing to pay a premium for certified sustainable spikenard oil and to be skeptical of uncertified oil, then the economics work. If they just want the cheapest option, the wild harvesting and adulteration will continue.
It comes back to us.
Which is uncomfortable, because nobody likes being told their purchasing decisions have consequences. But they do. Every bottle of spikenard oil you buy is a vote for how you want this industry to operate.
All right, I think we've covered the botany, the chemistry, the history, the economics, the ecology, and the ethics. Is there anything we missed?
I think we hit the major points. The only thing I'd add is that if anyone listening is curious about the scent itself, it's unique. Earthy, woody, slightly musky, with this almost damp, rooty undertone. It's not a crowd pleaser like lavender or citrus. It's strange and complex and not for everyone, but it's memorable.
If you do want to try it, maybe look for that fair trade certification. Or better yet, find a supplier who can tell you exactly where it came from and how it was harvested.
Transparency is the best signal. If a company can't tell you the source, assume it's unsustainable.
Good rule of thumb for a lot of things. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1970s, a Japanese clockmaker in Hokkaido named Masahiro Kikuno began crafting wristwatches with entirely handmade components, including a wooden mainspring carved from Japanese boxwood, a technique no one else was using at the time.
A wooden mainspring. I have so many questions.
I have zero answers.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop and to Daniel for the question. If you enjoyed this, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.